Last week we spoke about the topic of Mois Alai, about the issue of what happens when the wife has some type of subjective, not inherently visible issue with her husband, and whether or not that's an area in which a get can be forced. And we saw the view of the Rambam was that it can be forced in such a case. The view of most other Rishonim was that it could not be forced. There was an in-between possibility that there was an institution of the Gaonim that we should force a get based on that, and that also a lot of the Rishonim didn't accept. So we saw that essentially this is a big problem. It seems to be in my focus, I was showing him with most of the Rishonim saying that we can only be kofeh a divorce in the situations that are actually mentioned in Chazal, with some discussion as to whether these categories should be broader to include things that are not obviously in them. That's also a discussion, but still the halacha, most are going to assume that it has to be the cases mentioned in Chazal itself. So that leaves us with an important question. So how do we address contemporary situations where most of them are going to fall somewhere in between? Most of the cases of contentious divorces that we find nowadays, we don't really have a situation of a clear link to the cases in Chazal. Maybe they enter into the category of Mois Alai, maybe not. Probably most likely that's where they land. Most likely they are described as Mois Alai. And that being the case, so the question is, if we're lacking basis for Kfiyah, how do we handle it? So before getting to that head on, I just want to mention one more point as kind of a transitional point. So this question of why Kfiyah applies sometimes and why it doesn't, and when it applies and when it doesn't apply. So I mentioned, we discussed a little bit some insights of Rav Goldberg, who's the author of the Sefer, Eilu Shekhov Mahotzi. I think I've mentioned the time. There is also a volume put out by Otzra Poskim. It's written by the Tzvi Gardner, a very prominent Dayan involved in issues of Gittin and many other things. And his volume of Tzvi Beget, so he discusses what exactly the premise of compelling a get is. And why is it that Mois Alai is subject to machlokes? So I just want to share that with you as kind of a transitional point. So you may recall that we had discussed what the basis for Kfiyah Beget is, and we saw that the Rambam seems to maintain it comes from the mitzvah, or at least that the mitzvah addresses the issue that the get has to be beratzon. While other Rishonim were not necessarily coming from there, we're coming from a perspective that sounds like Afkeinu, that sounds like Chazal have dismantled the marriage internally, and therefore the get is essentially a formality, but the marriage really was negated in and of itself. So it's interesting to note that Rav Gardner in his Sefer, he assumes that that's not the actual interpretation. So I just want to share with you the way he says it. The Rishon who was most explicitly associated with the Afkeinu idea, anyone remember who that was? And who was most explicitly associated with that idea of Afkeinu was the Radbaz. Now we saw that there are other Rishonim that were consistent with that reading, but the Radbaz seemed to say it most clearly. So here, Rav Gardner understands the Radbaz differently. He says here that the Tshuvas Radbaz, Chelik Dalet, Semen Aleph Resh Chav Ches, Kasa Vezel Lashono, Dibish Lama, Baal Polipus Vechaverov, Yordu Chachavim Lasov Das Kol Hanashim, Ve'einan Yecholos Lusbal. Chazal estimated, evaluated what the basic woman is capable of, the average woman is able to endure, and assume that these are not in that category. Which really does sound like that's a straight Afkeinu. That basically Chazal's word, Afkeinu, Hefkiu, Chachamim have undone the marriage through that get. And we discussed that a little bit as well, that it's not such a case where the get is not necessary. The get is still required. Is it required to Rabbanan? Is it required in the Torah? Is it that it becomes an effective get because of this? We spoke about that a little bit. But a get is necessary. That's, as we mentioned, a controversial point because there is a suggestion that nowadays if we don't have a get forthcoming, maybe we should be able to utilize some type of contemporary Afkenu. And others, we mentioned Abdam Nechemi Goldberg, others mentioned that we don't find Afkenu after a marriage has been consummated without an accompanying get, that the get has to be there as well. So that's not a viable strategy, he has argued. But in any case, so what does Rav Gartner say about the rabbis? Says a different interpretation. I read through his language. So he thinks that despite the language, the rabbis is not telling you that it's because of Afkenu. Ela kavanaso levarer hamikor v'chiyuv hagerushin ve'edel. Rather, his intent is to clarify the source of the chiyuv gerushin. What exactly is the basis to tell the husband that he's obligated to divorce his wife? Da'af she'isha kinuyu hila ba'ila ve'ein ha'ish motzi ela l'ritzona. That even though there is a kinyan ishus that the husband has regarding the wife, and he can only undo that willingly, harei kinuya hi lo ishuseha. Right, there is a mutuality here. So he has this kinyan ishus, which is because she is in a ishus relationship with him. Shelachein kol she itra ha ishus b'shir kazeh shestam isha. So if the marriage has deteriorated to such a point so that the average woman would not be able to endure it, would not be able to call that a marriage, so then that's already a reason to say that he's got to give up on this Kenyan and he has to divorce her. So essentially what he's saying is that a marriage at a certain level is so deficient, is so lacking, that therefore it's no longer a marriage, essentially. So what right does the husband have to maintain the kinyanishus when it's not functioning that way for the woman? So that, he suggests, therefore, is how the rabbis is understanding it. With the tshuva's Beis Ephraim, Ephraim's Al Margolius, and his tshuva's Avin Ezer, Simon Kufman Beis, Lochen Kassus, did not understand it that way. Where do you find such a chiyuv? Umikol shekein b'mayis alai l'haramba she'ena davar du'lanu v'lo l'bal. All the more so if there is a chiyuv kfiya according to the Ramba, b'mayis alai, we don't know what it's about, and the husband may not know what it's about. Rak b'piya anuchayin shomeres b'mayis alai. And all we have to go on is her claim that he's disgusting to her. The chivish feels dead, name of the government garish. So we say because of that, that listen, there's no marriage here, you have to divorce her. V'nichalei shehu omdin das kiilu histne b'shas kiddushin alpi drishas ha'isha she'im yulad bo mum she'ein yichal lispol she'im uchuyiv l'garisha v'dayti d'hachem l'skad shelo ayin shambor. So he suggests instead that the understanding was there are these certain rules that we find in Chazal that are unbearable, and that the understanding is that when the husband married her, he basically said that, listen, if any of these things ever develop, that I understand that you're marrying me on the assumption that I will release you under those circumstances, that you won't be expected to stay if that's the case. So essentially, there is a very nuanced difference here. But what he wants to build based on this, and you have to really pay close attention to see what he's getting at, but what he's basically saying is that there's two different models. So one is there is a chiyuv gerushin that comes from a mitzvah, because basically these are the terms. The husband can be implicitly understood to have said, listen, I understand if this ever reaches a certain point, I will end it. While the Rabbaz's understanding is that already the marriage has inherently deteriorated to such an extent that you no longer have the elements of a marriage here, so therefore it makes sense that the husband has to wake up and acknowledge reality and therefore divorce. So that distinction is interesting, and he wants to suggest in the footnote here, just to compliment what we saw last week, so he thinks that therefore this could create, in the understanding of some, a difference in what kfiyah is in the case of the Mishnah and kfiyah is in the case of Mois Alay. That maybe normal kfiyah, the idea is it's a kfiyah of mitzvah. Right? You recall that that's how we segued into the whole topic. We first talked about kfiyah by mitzvahs in general, and we saw that the so says kfiyah by mitzvahs has to have a bezdin because that's what's really needed for a get. I remember that's how we entered into this whole topic. And therefore, kfiyah by a get seems to be a mitzvah function. So he thinks that maybe you could say that the general kfiyah that's mentioned in the Gemara, that's a mitzvah kind of idea. But maybe the idea of Mois Alay, if it's something that you can be kofa on, like the Rambam, that's different. That's because maybe the marriage has been undermined to such an extent, and that's because the shibud v'zchus ha'ishal hiskarish, right? The woman has to say, essentially, this marriage no longer exists. And he wants to also suggest, or you could say, that maybe that's the machlokas, the Rambam and Rabbeinu Tam. That what was the main machlokas of Rabbeinu Tam, right? The Rambam says that you can be kofa for Mois Alay, and Rabbeinu Tam says not. And what did we assume was the major issue for Rabbeinu Tam? The concern of she's interested in somebody else. Right? So that's machlokas, you could say, possibly, he writes here. But according to the Rambam, kfiyah legerishin in the cases in the Gemara is because shibud v'zchus ha'isha is because essentially if the marriage is not there anymore, so then she has a right to demand to be released. V'imkein hu adin b'moredes, so that's also true even by a situation of moredes. V'ein tzorach locho shemo ineha nosmer l'acher. Right? Remember we asked the question last week, why was the Rambam that worried that she's interested in somebody else? So maybe it's because if it's a situation of Mois Alay already, as far as he understands, then the marriage is already undermined, and therefore she has the right to get out of it. For the Rabbeinu Tam, he was shem chiyuv mitzvah ba'almo, but according to Rabbeinu Tam, it's basically a mitzvah obligation. U'memeila dahani milei v'delek echshah sheneh nas nebacher. So then, that's only true if it's really one of these umdanas that we understood from the beginning that the marriage wouldn't continue. It doesn't make sense to say that the husband got married so as long as you never become attracted by anybody else. And so that would be something that wouldn't create such a mitzvah. And therefore, maybe that's the Beit Tam's issue. And when there's a mereda situation, he's worried about that, and that's why he's not willing to be kofa. Okay, everyone gets a basic gist? A little bit of a subtle distinction, but it helps us transition from the general issue of Mois Alay to what do we do if we don't really have a clear mandate to kfiyah. So, what are our options? Right, so, basically, what did we see? If you saw a little bit the Mar Makomos this morning, so let's try to flesh out a little bit. So, we understand that kfiyah normally has a certain character to it, and we know that we find the example of kfiya b'shutin. You're going to take the response literature and hit him with it. That's not what it means. Shoot him with a test, it means that you're going to hit him with six. You're going to actually physically force him. So now it becomes crucially important to figure out what do we mean by kfiya, what is kfiya, and what's not kfiya. Right? So are we saying that if kfiyah is not permitted, then anything less than that is also not permitted? What's the space? Where do we define our terms between what's called kfiyah and what's called less than that? Right? If we have terminology like we've seen so far, of chiyuv legarish, mitzvah legarish, that there are situations where we can't compel it, but we tell him he's obligated. So is that already too much pressure? Telling him he's obligated is not to make him feel bad? What's called pressure? What's not called pressure? Right, we talked about this in the context of stock also. Right, what's called willing and what's not called willing? Where do we draw the line? So what are your thoughts about this? If you wanted to try to define where something would be called compelling and not compelling, so what kind of principles might you use? How would you, any particular method of pressure? Right, so I hit you, I look at you funny, I tell you you can't come to shear, I tell you I'm not going to eat lunch with you, how would you define these different things? What would you, I call you funny names. So how would you, if you tried to draw lines, how would you draw the lines? You want to take a stab at it? Sammy? Well,
maybe you could draw a line between like physical harm and something that's more...
Okay, so there is such a possibility, and we'll see, right, that maybe it's absolutely defined as physical and not physical. Right, that maybe physical, that already conveys a certain type of pressure, and that anything less than physical is already not that. Now again, there might be strong basis to say that, but you want to try to substantiate that a little bit? Why would you make such a distinction?
Because I think maybe only by physical can you say that someone's completely doing it against their will, because otherwise it's in...
I think you're onto something.
100% what I'm saying.
I think you're onto something. Let's just try to flesh out a little more. Like, why would that be true?
I was going to say because that would be true because in that case you're under so much pain, really, mm-hmm. that you're forced. You can't say anything else because you're under an excruciating amount of pain. Whereas when it comes to emotional things, you still have an ability to say yes and you decide in your mind what you want to do.
Okay, so let's explore that a little bit, right? So maybe pain is uniquely disabling, uniquely disconnects you from your ability to make independent decisions, and therefore anytime somebody is under the influence of pain, it's already not considered to be willing. Right? Ironically, you know, the Rambam, who's, you know, so to speak, the makel here, if that's the phrase you want to use, so maybe he is actually the source of that, right? Maybe he's basically saying when he describes the kfiya as knocking out the Yetzirah, so we could say that's exactly the issue, that basically the kfiya in terms of hitting somebody is that which does not allow you to focus on anything other than the pressure coming in front of you, and maybe physical pain is something that rises to that level. That's a possibility. Any other suggestions why it might be specifically that? Right?
It could be that it's still rational reasoning, but it's the wrong rational reasoning. Like the Chovas Yair that we had, mm-hmm. that you just want to prevent more pain instead of actually wanting to give the get or whatever it is. So perhaps it's for the wrong reasons that you are giving the get.
Which I get is an extension of the same idea, that it's so uniquely distracting that all you can focus on is getting rid of this pain, and not on any other type of consideration you might have, possibly. I think there's elements of that. I think there's also the fact that, first of all, you're dealing with something which is otherwise prohibited, right? You know, that which is also noteworthy, right? The fact that this is normally something you're not allowed to do, hitting somebody with sticks or with anything else, so that kind of calls attention to the fact that it is a extraordinary tool of the courts to try to influence someone to behave in a socially acceptable fashion. And therefore, it may be something which uniquely represents something which is beyond voluntary.
Why would that not apply to other things? Why would you be allowed to influence financial pressure on someone?
Well, what kind of financial pressure are we talking about? So let's explore that, okay? So if you're trying to say that financial pressure should be in the same category as hitting, now first of all, you'll see, we'll get more into the details of financial pressure, that financial pressure is a very controversial topic. But why are you assuming that financial pressure is the same kind of thing as hitting based on what we just said? You might be right, you might be wrong, but why?
From what I understood, you were saying that reasoning hitting is in its own category because that's something that we're not allowed to do seemingly from
right.
The Torah, that you can't hit someone like that. But I would say so too at any type of financial pressure. We have plenty of Isurim regarding monetary obligations and regarding...
Right, but what kind of obligations are we talking about? What do you imagine financial pressure to include?
To include not buying or selling, like putting a total boycott on somebody.
So is that an Isur by itself?
Business.
Is that something Torah prohibits specifically?
I don't know, I feel like you would know better than me.
No, but the point is, like, what are you envisioning? Is that necessarily in the same category? Right? If you were talking about stealing his money, right, so then maybe that's what we're talking about. But I don't know if anybody necessarily sees it that way. Although, you know, one could then question if we impose fines on him. So if the fines would be considered illegitimate, then that would essentially be equivalent to stealing. right? But if you're talking about breaking into his house and taking his stuff, so menachanami, right, that would equal something that probably might be in that category. Or now you'll sometimes see with a mob, right? If you're gonna come and start smashing his tires or start vandalizing his house, so menachanami, maybe that would be in a similar category. And I don't think that's something we really see as acceptable. You know, and that's a little bit actually the subject of the current trial, which I guess is a verdict from the trial, even at the trial that's going on. So there, you know, the kind of behavior that represents actual crimes becomes maybe all in that category, although the premise there is that if it's cases that justify kvia, that's why they're claiming that it's acceptable. But maybe that's the category, that maybe things that normally you would not be able to do without justification, so maybe that constitutes kvia. Hi?
But the financial pressure could be so stressful to the person that it's as if they're being hit. It could be that it would occupy their every thought. I can't make a business, can't support a family.
So now you're flipping back to the previous point, right? So what Tammy was saying, what Sammy was saying about that, you know, pain is so distracting that you can't focus on anything else, so therefore you can't make a decision that's really rational because all you're interested in doing is getting rid of the pain. So you're saying that theoretically financial pressure could rise to that level too, that something that's so debilitating is that you can't think of anything else because your financial worries have so overcome that maybe that'll be in the same category. Now, that's a good point, right? So, and again, we've seen that no one should assume yet that financial worries are immune from this issue. We're going to see, it should be a separate topic. I want to get into, hopefully by tomorrow or the next day, into the distinct area of kfi al yidei mamon, of where exactly money fits in, which is going to lead us into major issues regarding the prenup and the like. But what you're basically alluding to is, so how would you draw the line based on what you just said? I would think that the line would be drawn in a different kind of way.
Is it, I mean, whatever would not rise to the level of stressful that you can't make other decisions or other considerations?
Okay, right. So basically you're saying you're drawing the line. It's not really about method, right? It's really about degree.
It's really about degree,
right? That maybe you should say that anything that rises to the level of complete, all-consuming stress, that will be considered kvia, and anything below that threshold might not be. So therefore, maybe financial pressures could rise to the level of kvia, maybe anything like that could rise to the level of kvia, while maybe even hitting somebody, if he's a strong guy and you're just gently slapping him in the face, once every 2 weeks, maybe you can endure that without having to worry about it. And maybe hitting is also not so objective. Right? Maybe we should define it all by degree. Anything that's going to be all-consuming, that's going to be kvia. Anything that you could theoretically overcome if you wanted to, that's not going to be considered kvia. Sammy, you had more thoughts about that?
In that scenario, though, then you would have to be able to go like by a case-by-case basis, because that changes depending on the person what is considered
it might,
stressful.
It might, which is interesting. It's not off the table that might be the case. Right? Or it might be that fear may indeed shift from person to person, which might be something we have to consider. Any other thoughts about line drawage? Sammy, 20 seconds.
You talking more of stuff, and this talks about, you know, getting impaired, how that's more severe than malchus even.
Okay, so cheren, the Gemara, based on the Gemara, the Rishonim point to the Gemara, that just mathematically speaking, that the Gemara seems to tell us that cheren is more intense than malchus. And if malchus, that's basically kfiya b'shutim, right? We know somehow that hitting crosses the line. So if we do the math, and cheren is more than hitting, and hitting crosses the line, so that's why some of the Rishonim say cheren must also cross the line. But is that just so we have that source, so we have to apply the math, or is there a lumbus to it?
What
does
cheren
mean
here?
So what do the words exactly mean?
Yeah.
Right, so the exact terminology we're going to have to see, just to say a word about the concept, So cheirim, just so you know, is a very serious idea, practically speaking. Cheirim, which is translated into English as, let's say, excommunication, has a lot of different nuances in halakhic literature, cheirim, nidui, shamta, etc., a lot of different words. And in English, there are different words, ban, excommunication, etc., ostracizing, right? Whether these words have exact, precise definitions, we have to figure out, because it's going to make a difference. But the concept of a cheirim is really a curse. A cheirim is essentially a curse, and basically, as Rashefri often explains, it's a curse that the person involved should drop dead. And it's a pretty intense idea. You know, that's especially because we give certain levels of power to blessings and to curses, brachas and to curses. So then that carries a certain power to it. And the halachos of cheirim are discussed, among other places, in Maseches Moed Katan, together with the halachos of avelos. That's the point, again, Rashefter often makes, of course, the Netziv, that the reason they're connected is because you essentially treat the person in cheirim as if he is dead, and that he is basically sitting shiva for himself. So therefore, he takes on practices like an avel because he is regarding himself as dead. So essentially, the cheirim is a very strong tool, which we don't take lightly. Which is not something that we assume we can just casually throw around. And therefore, it seems like, as Rishonim are saying, that if the kfiya is not called for, then cheirim is also not called for. Cheirim must cross the line from kfiya. And we know that essentially from a kal v'chomer, that basically if the Gemara says it's worse than hitting, then this is also past the line. So can we substantiate that a little bit more? Can we say, so what does, how do we know then that this non-physical curse is going to be worse than or in the same category as something which is physical punishment, aside from the mathematics of rayus from the Gemara that one is worse than the other, but how do we understand it conceptually? So then, how are we dividing our lines? So this doesn't necessarily, cheirim doesn't necessarily enter into, doesn't necessarily enter into the question of physical punishment, although it's, you know, spiritual physical punishment, the idea is it's a klala to die, so then it connotes physical punishment, but it's not brought about physically. So how do we draw the line? It's interesting, and it's the whole question is to what extent the law recognizes these things. We mentioned last week or before that many of the types of kriya run into issues with dina de malchusa dina. Should know that sometimes, I've seen cases like this, where even issues of social ostracism can also be addressed by the government. It's a very tricky area, but sometimes you could have a question whether this might be grounds for a lawsuit, for example, because there are areas of civil law which could be relevant to issues of social treatment. There could even be criminal issues. Let's say, for example, let's say it's an Arkoa situation where there's a courtroom issue and people's testimony are involved. So anything that could influence testimony of people sometimes is a criminal offense. And that has affected what rabbis are able to do in terms of issues like this. It's a serious concept. Right.
In Israel, they can be put in prison for refusing to get, right?
Correct, and depending on some circumstances, and last week we read together the Tshuva of Rav Avadya Yosef, where that was considered, and where he said that the jail in Israel is different than the jail in earlier generations. It's a fascinating idea. You know, we distinguish between imprisonment and imprisonment. That's this whole parenthetic of the whole literature about whether jails are at all a Jewish punishment. Sorry?
You think technically not because they're fear, it's not so bad anymore.
Well, that's how we're divided it sounding like, but also just from the other direction, like there are those who think that jails just don't really have a place in Judaism, it's a whole different kind of thing. There's a lot of literature about that. Since Eliezer, which was led by, there's a lot, because maybe we don't find
very
it.
Inhumane.
How does it fit into the categories that we have? You know, it's not Misa, it's not Malkus. Mm-hmm.
I think
Amara talks about it. Amara talks about a kippah that I was referring to, that when that stops in a situation where they can't prove one way or another and a person's a threat to society, so it seems like that's a non-punitive path. There's a whole literature about this.
All right, Nick Luck, maybe fit into that.
It's more like...
When they took the Mikoshi's Yates and they held on to him for a while.
Right, right. So how does that fit in? Is that because they were waiting for punishment, so he's remanded into custody? So there's extensive literature about this. So this is parenthetically, whether it rises to the level of kfir or not, so that's also something that we'll have to figure out. Is anyone coming? So any other suggestions as to how to draw the line? Yes, sir?
Could public humiliation have a factor, meaning chayrin might be considered more public and perhaps hitting someone being bit as a humiliation factor?
So humiliation, so we discussed that as a sugya in and of itself, right? So certainly that is something to consider. We have to figure out exactly where that fits in, because that can go in both directions. So, but just in terms of how to draw a line, any other suggestions? There's one suggestion that may be correct or not. I'm just surprised no one has said it. I don't think anyone said it so far. It seems a little bit more of an intuitive distinction. Well, one might distinguish between active and passive. Right? One might say that we have no right to do something to this person if it's not kfir. But what if we're just talking about withholding things? If we're just talking about not providing benefits, maybe that's not kfir. So you'll live without these benefits. Shall we?
We're not doing this to someone because that can.
I think that's a part of the question, right? That maybe one could view that as passive and say that, okay, I'm not forcing him, I'm just not going to do business with him. He does whatever he wants. All right, so essentially, I think if we put that on the table too, so maybe through our discussion here, we've come up with three possible guidelines. I'll have to see if there are maybe some others, but maybe three possible dividing lines that suggested that maybe hitting represents something uniquely coercive, possibly because of its generally illegal nature, or maybe it's really a matter of degree that anything which is so distracting, so all-consuming, that you can't function any other way until the problem is dealt with, so then that's a form of kfiya, which again, hitting represents, but not exclusively. Or maybe we'll say it's about negative versus positive, which is in a sense a form of the first one, but different, that to do something to somebody is kriya. To withhold services from him is not necessarily called kriya. So what this is going to get us into now is you can see that if you've seen this morning, so the Rishonim basically lay down, and this is quoted by the Ramah who's in the middle of everything chronologically. So we'll start with him, and again, thank you to Aryeh for making these sheets. But if we look at the Ramah, so, which is here somewhere, the Ramah basically lays down the two sides of the issue. Right? That, on the one hand, the Chayrim is too much, Chayrim crosses the line, but, on the other hand, there are things we can do. And this is what's known today, and this is, through these sources, you'll see how it's introduced in the Rishonim. The concept, this is really an important buzzword in terms of Aguna activism today, very important term to be aware of, is that the assumption is I'm sure you've all heard about various methods of trying to make a recalcitrant husband recognize his obligations. So the assumption is that they are not chayrim. I think the average person would not be aware of that. The average person would think that the recalcitrant husbands we talk about are in chayrim, but we see that if that's the terminology we use, it's problematic. We've just seen that. And it's something lower than that. And what it's known as, and you see, in the sources today, you see why, it's known as the harchokos derbein etam, that they are, harchokos means distancing, right? Things that we do to distance ourselves from such a person, which are associated with Rabbeinu Tam. And it's relevant, of course, that Rabbeinu Tam is otherwise the Machmir, right? It's the same Rabbeinu Tam who says that we have to be very careful when we are kofa. We can't assume kfiya for Mois Alai or for other similar things. But there are still things we could do. So the two halves of the equation, that kfiyah no, and chayrim is included in kfiyah, but on the other hand, there are things we can do. Those are the harfakos of Rebbeinu Tam. So we have to get introduced to that and then figure out how to understand why they're acceptable and what they include and when are they acceptable. So let's look together at the Ramah. The Ramah here is Kuf Mem Dalet Chaf Aleph. It's on the sheets here. Kol Eilu She'amar Lahotzi Kofin Afilu B'Shutin. And so anyone who we are told that Kfi is possible, then we can force even by hitting them. V'yesh Omrim She'kol Mishalo Namar Bo B'Gemar B'Ferish Kofin Lahotzi. Anything that's not said explicitly that we do kfiya, ella yotzi bovad, rather you just are told to divorce without kfiya, ein kofi b'shutin el omer lo, you don't use sticks, but you say to him, chachal b'machayvuko lehotzi, b'lo sotzi mutter l'kros v'azariyin. Right, that's from the Shulchan Aruch so far. And so we see now a distinction is also important, that shutin no, Avarian, yes. Now, Avarian is not nothing, right? I mean, how many of us want to be called a sinner? And what degree of public are we talking about? And Arya brought up a few minutes ago the issue of Habanas B'nei Chaver Rabbim. So presumably, if the rabbi, at least, and maybe more than the rabbi, are referring to you as an Avarian, so presumably that's embarrassing. And it's definitely something. It's definitely the kind of thing that people sue other people over, right? So it's got to be a significant step. So it sounds like already the Shulchan Aruch is saying, here's the distinction. Avarian, yes. Kfiya, Peshutin, no. Okay, so much that we see from the Shulchan Aruch. So now enters the Ramah, and he says, since there is a machlokas among the Rishonim, Roy lahachmir, then it's appropriate to be machmir. Shlo lokof Peshutin, not to be involved in hitting with sticks, shlo yehei aget musa, because we don't want the get to be forced in a illegitimate way. Aval, im yeshlo isha ba'aveira, if he's married to somebody in a prohibited way, l'kli amokof m'shitin, fine. V'chol mokom she'ein kof m'shitin, now here's the important part for us, any situation where we say kfiya b'shutin is not acceptable, a menad no sogam ken, we also cannot put the person into legally. We can't put them into legally. So that much, says the Ramah, we can't do. But in the same breath, he takes away and he gives. He says, we can't say them, we can't do. And he quotes the Rishonim, which could be Saul, the Mordechai, and Mordechai quoted that Gemara and Pesachim that we mentioned. All right, so look at the Mordechai for a second together. That's a phrase from the Gemara, that word's not going to really make a difference. Then you can only use words. So again, there you have a distinction. Kfiya no, words, yes. The shamta chamir m'negida, and not with chayrim, because that's worse than getting hit. Anagdul manu ashamta, the Gemara basically says ashamta is worse. Skip a little bit of Ramah Kohen, over to Shem Rebbeinu Tam, that there's something we can do. So now we'll come back to that. So what can we do? So while it's back in the Ramah, when we call Makal Nicholin Ligzer al Kol Yisrael, we can make a gezerah on the entire Jewish people. Shalo la'asos lo shum tova, we should not do anything good for him. Oh, Lisa the Litain Imo, nor should we do business with him. Oh, Lamu Banav, a reason to give a bris to his sons. Oh, Lakavro, or to bury him. Ad Shi Garesh, until he divorces. Uvachol Chumra Shi Yirtu Bezin Yacholu Mahachmir B'kai Gavna, Umuvad Shloy Nadroso. And the Bezin apparently has permission, has latitude to be pre-machmer within this, as long as it's not needed. Aval mishen v'chaim onu yichol ndos l'achrim v'chaim onu shigarish. But somebody who is not willing to fulfill his marital obligations, so then you can still, then you can excommunicate him, that he should either be mekayim his ona, or he should get divorced. Ki ein zek fiyah rak v'chaim onoso. Because the kfiya, it's interesting, this print, the comma is there. I'm not sure if the comma should be there.
Right.
I know, but I'm not sure. Would you agree that the comma belongs there? Because the point is not so much that it's not kfiya, the point is that it's not kfiya on the get. That the kfiya is on his marital obligations. V'chein kol yotzev is there, and also similar things. V'chein mishigarish yishtu beget kosher, and also somebody who married, divorces with a good get, v'yotzev sat lazal get, and then they start telling rumors the get wasn't kosher, and mutter l'chofa lost his get acher, then you can force him to give another get. V'l'chamakum dika plukta in kofin or lo, any place where there's a machlokas, if you're kofin or not, afal gad din kofin l'garech, n'chamakum kofin us to think subim b'yam. Right, and then, even if there's a situation where there's a machlokas about kfiya, so then, even if we can't force the get, we can force the ksuba. V'chein ha'nidunya dan alzbe, and also the dowry we can force him to give back. So, this Ramah, again, represents the view of many before him and after him. He's building on many Rishonim that quote Rebbe Natan, and many later who build on this. And that leaves us with a number of questions, which we're going to have to try to clarify. We'll probably end up clarifying most of them tomorrow, but let's try to lay out the issues in the next few minutes. So as far as tomorrow, there's any more marmakomos? Everyone's still working on the sheet? All right, so still working on the sheet. All right, so we have to figure out what's special about the Harchakos Rebbein Natan. So, first of all, one question to ask is, are we essentially saying that the Harchakos Rebbein Natan are not kfiya at all? Or they represent some type of in-between stage, that there are circumstances where we're not clear that kfiya is called for, but Harchakos Rebbein Natan don't cross the line. But in a situation where there's nothing that could be construed as justifying kfiya, then maybe our halakas Rebbein Natan are also going to be a problematic. So that's one question we have to figure out. Is this really completely non-kfiya? Or is it a different kind of calculus? But if it's not kfiya, so why is it not kfiya? So if you saw, you got a little bit of a taste of it, if you got further on the sheet, that different Rishonim, first of all, part of the magic of being Rebbein Natan, is that other Rishonim quote you more than you write yourself, even though, as you see here, you do have the Sefer HaYashar Rebbein Natan. But being an influential Rishon, it's kind of like the Bahag, right? So most of the citations we have from the Bahag are from other Rishonim, sometimes giving different versions. That's why, so like in Hilchos Megillah, it becomes a big story, what does Bahag really mean? So too, Rebbein Natan sometimes finds himself quoted in different ways by other Rishonim. So here, this becomes a very significant issue. You have a couple of different girsos in what Rebbein Natan is really based on. So, just from what you've seen or from what you think, so why is Rebbein Natan okay with this, right? The same Rebbein Natan who's somewhat machmir on kfiya beget, but he's willing to allow these harchakos, why is that? What would you say so far? Why do these harchakos not cross the line? Yes? But why not? So how do we define kfiya? That's what we're trying to figure out. So what constitutes kfiya and not, so that these are not outright kfiya? Is the emphasis on the word outright?
Significant distress of any sort, you're just kind of like steadily making life a little more uncomfortable for him.
Okay, so then let's focus on that phrase. Right? Because it could be, that's how some of the Rishonim understand it, that basically what you see, when you said outright, so outright might be a question of direct versus not direct. You know, that which also, it was an interesting, well, we didn't even say that before, maybe that's an interesting way to address it. Maybe we could say that it's not even a question of degree or other things, but we could say that if there's a direct line between what we're doing and the result, then that's too much kfiya dik. That's too much like we're compelling this result. But even if we made your life absolutely miserable, but we did it in ways that were less overtly connected, but just when you happen to cooperate, all of a sudden your life gets better, then maybe that's not called kfiya. So you could have been alluding to that when you said outright or not outright. But then you said something else, which seems like some of the Rishonim read it this way, and we'll have to see that a little bit more, that it's not kfiyut because, you know, let him live without doing business with anybody, and let him live without having a bris milah for his sons, and let him live knowing that if he dies, we're not going to bury him. Okay, you know, but he can still spend his days playing video games and whatever it is, and, you know, especially now, so we have the internet, and he'll do whatever he wants. And we're just not going to hang out with him. That's not fear, you know. When you're being whacked, you know, so you're so blinded with pain that you can't do anything until you get the pain to stop. So it's not happening here. So you just won't do business with us. So there are some Rishonim who seem to read it that way. Sam?
This seems to be the passive distinction that you mentioned at the end.
Might be, but it might be. But I think, again, you'll see that there are a lot of different ways to read Rabbeinu Tam, so without taking it aside completely, but I think what we were saying a minute ago is that that's more about the degree issue. That maybe we'll say, listen, he could live with this. I mean, it's not fun, you know, it's not going to make his parents proud, but it's not what they always wanted for him, but it's a life, you know, whatever it is. So if that's the life he chooses, so fine, we're not forcing him to do anything.
Right. Doesn't seem to fit into the illegal aspect, meaning not burying the dead or not giving a bris milah. He's not giving a bris milah. Seems to not be okay from a Jewish standard, right? And we have a community has an obligation in general to do that.
As a chesed, usually it's really his obligation, right? So the kid said, listen, we're not going to circumcise your kid. You figure it out. Normally, you're right, especially with meal with kvur, all the more so, it's normally understood to be a basic chesed obligation to society. It's okay, so you're not worthy. You know, it's an interesting topic in this week's parsha that we talk about in Parshas Kedoshim. We talk about v'losikom v'lositor, which some of the Rishonim understand to mean that you should not hold back chesed from people just because they themselves are not worthy of it. So maybe there is a certain threshold where they're not worthy of it. But it's an interesting question to explore. But so one possibility is, like you're saying, that maybe it's livable with. That's how some seem to understand it. And there is a different version which appears in the Ma'arik, and the Gra quotes it, that the issue is that, listen, if he doesn't like it, let him go somewhere else. And so right here, we're not hanging out with him. But let him find somewhere else where he can somehow make a life for himself. So just went to the shortest version of this. So it comes up towards the end of the list here. The Gra, the Vilna Gaon, quotes this idea, which is in some of the Shonim, that, but it's not at all the only reading of the Rabbeinu Tam. So says the Gra over here from the last page of the sources, the Yachal li natzel mizeh leilech liyacheres. Right, so there we find two svaras here. And then he adds on, because so first of all, the idea that it's not physical, which relates to the point that Sammy said before, so maybe that's not called isui, that's not called compelling. But the first svara that he mentioned, that listen, he's not forced to do anything. Who asked him to live here? So he'll move to a different city where they're not going to treat him this way. Which, you know, poses all kinds of interesting questions. Does that have to be a given? Is that the assumption of the Rabbeinu Tam? You know, what if you actually had global reach? Let's say you could effectively create a situation where there is nowhere in the world for him to go. So, of course, in our society today, we are both closer and farther from that than we ever have been, because we actually have a way to communicate with the whole world at once. But at the same time, so nobody listens to anybody else, so it's not going to matter that, and this I also know from experience in these situations, that there always will be, so to speak, your mikvah for a Palestinian husband. There always is a chevra somewhere that he can go to. So even if, it's an interesting question to ask, you know, would the definition of Rabbeinu Tam Shachakis change if you could create a scenario where there's nowhere else for him to move to? But factually, even with the World Wide Web, it's not clear that that's possible. Right.
The Ramah has a language of Libzerol, Kol Yisrael. So it sounds right. Like, at least the way the Ramah brings down Rabbeinu Tam Shachakis, there's really nowhere he can go.
Yeah, it's an interesting question how much to pay attention to that phrasing. does it mean that the assumption is that that's not consistent with this reading, that he's really talking about everywhere, or are we saying that you'll make your gezeira here, and the fact is that the rest of Jews and the rest of the world aren't going to necessarily hear you or pay attention to you, but here in Washington Heights, he's saying that no Jews should be involved in it. So we'll have to expand on this tomorrow, just to try to quickly recap what we've seen so far today, a couple of important points. So we talked about the general question of what is it that is the basis for kfiyah. In the past, we mentioned that the Rambam seems to come from the mitzvah perspective, while the Radbaz sounds like he's talking about Afkienu. We saw that Rav Gartner, in his Sefer Kfiyah Beget, says he's not talking about Afkienu, but he's saying that when the marriage is essentially collapsed, then there is no ishus between the two, so it's right for the husband to give up his claim on the ishus, while others understand it differently, that basically it's a mitzvah which emerges from the fact that essentially this was the understanding when they got married, that should things ever reach this point, that he would give her a get. And that explanation was brought into the question of kfiyah by Ma'is Alai, according to the Rambam. What kind of kfiyah is that? Is that the same as a mitzvah kind of kfiyah, or is that a kfiyah based on the marriage essentially being hollowed out? And maybe that's the machlokes between the Rambam and Rabbeinu Tam, that the Rambam thinks that all kfiyah maybe is because marriages have internally collapsed, and therefore we're not even worried about Shema Nasna Inah Ba'acher, while Rabbeinu Tam sees it more as a function of mitzvah, and therefore we do have to worry that that mitzvah is not really legitimately there. So then we transition to the question that if kfiyah indeed is not fully justified, so how do we make sure not to cross the boundary into kfiyah? So the only thing we knew first is that kfiyah includes hitting the person, so we know that that's kfiyah, so we know that defines something. So we had a couple of suggestions as to where the line might be drawn. The suggestion was made that maybe hitting someone physically constitutes a unique coercive act. We discussed whether maybe all types of illegal things, otherwise illegal things, might be in that category. There was also the suggestion it's all a matter of degree. Anything that's so distracting that you can't focus on anything else is kfiyah. Anything short of that is not. We also discussed the possibility that maybe it's a distinction between doing things and not doing things. And then the possibility was also suggested maybe direct coercion, do this or we'll kill you, so to speak. That's clear coercion, but more indirect methods where just your life is miserable, but it gets better once you cooperate, maybe that's not called kfiyah. So then we saw that the Rabbeinu Tam is quoted by many Rishonim, ultimately in the Ramah, where the Ramah tells you both sides of the equation. That on the one hand, if you can't do kfiyah, then you can't do cheirim either. Cheirim, we discussed, according to the Gemara, sounds to be labeled as more chomer than hitting, and then we discussed why that is, what a cheirim is, if all the person should die, with all the consequences that connect to that. So that's apparently off limits. But there is something that is doable. So what is that? We saw in the Shulchan Aruch, sometimes you can call him an avarian. You saw in the Mordechai and others references to using words. And you saw this concept of the Harchakas Derbeinu Tam, that there are certain distancings you can do from this person, and that's apparently acceptable to the same Rabbeinu Tam who says that you have to be hesitant to be kofet. And we tried to figure out why that is. We mentioned there'll be a couple of possibilities, but the two possibilities we discussed so far in the past few minutes is that maybe they don't rise to the level of complete unlivability. It's unpleasant, it's not really such a right home about lifestyle, but you could choose to take this lifestyle and go along your merry way. Or the second, emphasizing going along your merry way, that if there's always a possibility, if you want, you can get up and move to somewhere else, so then who's forcing you to do anything? You could just decide to live in a different place and not have this issue. And we discussed the question, so what if nowadays maybe we would say that you really could have global reach, so would that change what's called the Rabbeinu Tam or not? On the one hand, it's interesting how theoretically we actually could communicate with the whole world today. On the other hand, the Matzias is that still nobody's going to listen to you. There will always be people who will not listen to you. And I can tell you again from real-life situations that the presence of all the internet efforts in the world is not going to stop there from being a place of refuge for counseling husbands to go to. And therefore, maybe that's good in the sense that it upholds the stature of Harkokas Ben Tam as not constituting fear. So God willing, we will explore that for a little bit more tomorrow. And we will have a minute.